Test.
Yep, we're rolling. Geez, I should check these dials. I hope I didn't leave that on slow speed at Seymour. Okay, it's the 21st of August, 2001. I'm Dan O'Neill, and I'm sitting in Terry McMullen's cabin at the mouth of the 70 Mile. And what a place it is. Huge view, beautiful log work. And Terry's good enough to give me a little time to talk about his life on the river. And if, with your permission, Terry, I would put this in the oral history archives at University of Alaska, together with all these 40-odd probably interviews now.
Yeah, we've done. Problem.
And I am working on a book that will cover some of the story of the river people as well. So, with that, thanks, Terry. Maybe could you just tell us to start with where you were born and raised and how you came to be up in this country?
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in Red Wing, Minnesota, and came to Alaska originally in 1962 as a school teacher and a basketball coach at Kodiak, Alaska, and taught there a couple of years. And I moved up to Copper Center, Alaska, and taught there for 3 years. And this was the rural type situation. I was one of a two-teacher school there. And taught there for 3 years. And then I came to Eagle in 1967 to teach at the Eagle Village.
Did you say what year you came to Alaska?
1962. So I came in, in Eagle Village in 67 and taught there. And that was a one-teacher school, so I was in charge of the 8 grades there. And I was the first, what we called, state teacher there, Division of the State-Operated School System. And that school was had just been taken over by the state from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And I was the first teacher to teach there for the state. So that's how I got up in this country. And, I started... kind of getting out in the country and doing some trapping and hunting up here during the years I taught there. And then 1970, I dropped out of teaching, and my family and I, which is Mary Ann and 4 kids, moved down here to the 70 Mile. So.
And how old were your kids when you moved them down here?
I think my youngest girl was in the first grade, second grade, and the oldest, I think, was in the 7th grade. So they were, that would be, what, 6, 7 years old, 11 or 12. I know they're pretty bunched up close together as kids, 3 girls and a boy. And
now, how did you convince your family to come down here?
Well, originally we were just going to do this thing for a year and, make the... we've been talking about doing something like that. And I had built this cabin down here in the 70 Mile in a couple of years before that time and used it to trap out of. And, I'd come down to fall and do some hunting. And so actually we just built onto that, and that's where we moved into.
And that's a cabin a mile or so up?
About a mile up from the mouth, yeah, from here. And it has, it's off the Yukon, so it has, you don't see the Yukon from that cabin. I'm going to pour that tea.
Okay.
If you want to take it.
Yeah. See if I get some water.
Was it the minerals that sort of cake up in there?
Pardon?
Is it pretty mineralized water?
Here?
Yeah.
It's not too bad.
I know in my teapot, it's
usually
scales up. I don't know if it's calcium or something.
But it would just, I think the pot was old to begin with. And you said you didn't eat sugar,
right? Right, yeah, I'm good, thanks.
Thank you.
So that was 1970, and then we lived down here for 5 years, till I went out and worked in the. And then I had to go to work. I went to work in the pipeline. I drove truck on the pipeline, and for 2 years, and came back in 77, and then 79, we moved back up to Eagle.
So 77 to 79 here also.
Mm-hmm.
Whole family.
One of the girls was gone by that time.
Uh-huh.
My oldest daughter. She now lives in Fairbanks.
That's something I should add to this list sometime. Would be the River People kids. What did they think of all this stuff? You know, like.
Yeah.
Leaf was up there, you know, he took off, but I was kind of interested to hear, you know, what the hell did you think of being born in this little log cabin and stuff?
Yeah, he really was. He was born in it right there at Shade Creek.
Right. And Randy Brown had kids out there.
Well, my kids were old enough. I don't think I would have, I know I wouldn't have had babies out there. You know, I don't think we'd have done that, you know. My like I said, the youngest was in first grade, and these kids were already messing with dogs and stuff before we, you know, came down here, and you know, they'd hunt with me and stuff, and they were pretty capable, and they got more so as we lived down here, and I think they grew up awfully self-reliant, and they are to this day. And close.
Did they take much convincing at that time? I could see the seventh grader as thinking.
No, not really. Well, maybe a little bit. You know, maybe a little bit. But I, you know, she talks very highly of it now, of the experience, you know.
The oldest one's a girl.
Pardon? No, she's a girl, yeah. The oldest is a girl. I have two older girls. My one daughter's at the cafe there. She's married to Dennis Lehman. Dennis and Sheila, they own the pole operation there, you know. That's my second oldest daughter. And then my son is a fish and wildlife trooper down in southeast. He's just moving to Haines now in about a month from Prince of Wales Island. Then I have a younger daughter who now lives in Tennessee, my youngest, who was the only Alaskan-born child. She was born in Kodiak. So.
Okay, and then 79, you moved back to Eagle?
Yeah, and then I went back as principal teacher at the school, which has now became a K-12 program rather than a K or 1-8 program, you know. So I went back as a high school, one of the high school teachers, and then the principal in charge, administrator, school administrator.
One thing I wanted to be sure to get is, since you were out here, let's see. So maybe you moved to Eagle in 67. When did you start actually getting down to 70-mile trapping and hunting and stuff?
Well, that first winter, I started trapping with one of the guys out of the village, and we trap out the 70-mile trail. I don't know if you're familiar where that goes or not. Out of Eagle goes out and hits the 70-mile about 16 miles up. And we'd go out there and hunt, kind of trap that trail, and nobody, absolutely nobody, was trapping an eagle at that time. There was a fellow by the name of Mike Molchin, who was an old-time trapper and snarer, and he was working for the government. He was trapping for the government, for the federal government, and they were doing some research on radioactive fallout. And he was doing catching fur. I think he was like a GS 12 or 13 or something with the federal government, and they put him. They gave him an Alpine, and he worked here in Eagle, and then he worked. And then he also had a trap line over around the Delta, Mount Hayes, and he was. They wanted the fur. They wanted the fleas off the fur. That's really what they were looking at. And then Mike got to keep his fur besides, so he had a heck of a deal. Well, he'd come into Eagle, And he trapped out the 7 mile trail about 6 or 7 miles, and then trapped out the Taylor Highway. And but absolutely nobody else trapped. I mean, nobody was here, you know. Dick Cook was living in Eagle, and Dick had dogs at the time, but he didn't trap. He just kind of stayed in Eagle and ran his dogs. He'd come out to visit the school a lot and run his dogs out there.
Was the school out in the village?
Yeah, it was in the village. And it's now since been demolished. You know, after the program moved to Eagle itself in 85, then that building sat there till about just 3-4 years ago, and they started vandalizing it and stuff, and so finally, they just ended up tearing down. It was a lot of good stuff there, but they demolished it anyway.
What about, that's kind of what I understood too, is even into the early 70s, it was just about nobody living on the river in a traditional subsistence life of trapping in the winter, fish camp in the summer, raising a team of working dogs.
There were two or three wheels, fish wheels, in the town, in the village itself. The old guys that are no longer alive ran wheels.
Like who are they?
Who were they? Willie Juniby ran one, and then Susie Paul. His nickname Susie. Jose was his real name.
Oh.
And then I think he just dropped a one wheel, but I think that wheel used to put in so many fish that, and the natives were still, they still, you know, needed those fish, depend on those fish, and they all cut a lot of firewood at that time, but they weren't really trapping anymore. And they weren't really getting the amount of largesse from the government now, then, either. I mean, that was kind of the latter stages of that.
So these two guys running wheels would pretty much supply the whole village?
Yeah, in the village. Actually, in those days, I think when I first moved into that village for 2 or 3 years, I think there were maybe 18 or 20 people that lived in Eagle itself, the town, the white community.
Really?
In the winter. Huh. But there were a lot more people in the village, you know. There were, the second year I was there, in the village, I think we had maybe 16 or 18 kids in school, and mine were the only white kids that were in the school that year. Huh. It was a state school, but there just wasn't any white kids at that particular time living in Eagle.
Okay. So that first winter, 67-8, you got down here trapping out the 70-mile trail.
Yeah, I trapped marten mostly. You know, they're pretty easy to trap, and you run. There was that trail out there and stuff, you know, which was already there and stuff. And
did you run dogs or snowball?
My dogs.
And did you start out, or I shouldn't assume you changed, but most people did. Did you start out with great big dogs?
I brought the big dogs into this country.
Did you? Oh, from Bergrath?
Yeah.
Oh, I heard that, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a leader that, actually, I brought dogs. The summer before I came to Eagle, I had dogs down on the Juneau ice field, running dogs for hauling freight for Maynard Miller down there in the Juneau ice field research program.
Oh, really?
I did that in 67 and again in 70 or 71. So I had dogs. I brought dogs into Eagle with me. I had dogs. I'd started to run dogs in Copper Center. And that's how I got to know Roger, because Roger was raised Malamutes in Fairbanks. And so we exchanged a couple puppies and got to know him. I'm his friend to this day, you know.
Ah, okay.
So.
And then a lot of these, I call them the 70s people or the river people, ended up picking up a dog or two from you at different times?
Charlie Edwards got some dogs from me. He got a couple big dogs from me. And, Mike Potts did. And that's where a lot of those, I'm sure that's where they bred it. There were some, they got huge dogs. I mean, after that, though, I mean, Randy Brown had some tremendously big dogs and stuff. So they brought, they had some other dogs, you know, that my dogs, I say they were big dogs. They might have run 80, 85 pounds. They had dogs that went over 100, you know. And
I was thinking you had it up in that range.
No. I mean, that's a lot of dog. That's a lot of dog. And you don't see many of those. I mean, I had a couple of dogs that looked like they were that big, but they were heavily furred. And so, when, you know, they actually weighed in the 80s. So,
Wayne Hall's got some big fur balls.
No, I don't think so. Wayne's got six of my dogs right now that he's going to run the Quest this year. And he's
you kept dogs all these years?
I've had dogs since 64 in Copper Center, 65, something like that when I first got them. Started getting them.
Wow. I ran dogs too, and but we got pretty quick into, 55, 65 pounds.
Yeah, well, that's what these dogs of mine are. They run about 55 pounds now.
So you did come down.
Oh, yeah.
Well, breaking up those fights and, jeez.
Oh, those damn Malamutes. I tell you, there's no way you could. You couldn't do anything short of killing them. I mean, they just would fight, and, you know, they'd take a beating for it and be glad to take the beating because they like to fight so damn much. I mean, there's no doubt about it, you know?
Yeah, it just looked so... I mean, I never had a dog before I had a team, and when I was little, I had been bitten by German Shepherds, and one of my buddies and I, as kids running through a backyard, both got attacked, and he... to this day has a big chunk out of his leg.
Jeez, yeah.
So I was pretty spooked of dogs, and I still am a little bit.
Yeah.
I had them for 10 years. But when I see those big Malamutes and those fangs flashing, and the thought of wading in the middle of that churning mess just scares me.
I packed, I used to go, actually up until, I haven't gone up there about 3-4 years, but I used to hunt sheep in those mountains you see up I don't know if you see them. Actually, they're right on the other side of those trees, but they're up Sheep Creek.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I used to hunt sheep up there, and I used to pack dogs with me. I had two or three big dogs biggest dogs, and I had packs for them. And
did you, like, motor partway up?
Or yeah, no, well, I did. I do now, because I've got a jet unit on a 50-horse and a small boat that I go up there. I used to line a canoe up there, and I'd go up there. In fact, I used to... First couple times I went up there, I went up Pass Creek, you know, right there where Dick, just up from where Dick's property is. And you can get up into those mountains up Pass Creek, but then if you keep going up Sheep Creek, another 4 or 5 miles, you come to another place called Funnel Creek that comes out of those mountains. So that's where the way I go in now. And I used to use those big dogs, and I had two of them with their packs on. We were coming back down there, and I had this doggone sheep, and they all were packed, and I had horns and everything, you know, and I sat down by a little creek, and this is the first water we'd seen since we came off the mountain, and I was walking in this creek, and here was this little space. I went down there to get a drink, and I just sat down with my pack, and there was a little space. Everything else was banking water, and there was one dog came there, and he sat down there next to me, and here comes this other dog, you know. And this is the only spot you can sit, you know. And here that ornery son of a gun comes, and they started a fight. And I'm sitting there with this pack on, and I'm tired anyway. And they, with their packs on, this big old dumb dogs getting in this fight, right, and they're in my lap. I mean, they're literally in my lap. And, God, I'll never forget, I reached, and I was going to grab a collar, and and I know better. And I put my hand down in there, and just like a razor, boy. And then they got it, I'll tell you. I started bleeding, and then I got a little nauseated because of the situation, you know, and I cut my fingers. But anyway, yeah.
I know.
And then you had to have been tired. I mean, they've been walking and packing, you know.
Funny. I don't know how those old-timers handled those teams, you know. Maybe they just carried a 2x4 all the time.
Well, they didn't mess around with them, boy, I know that. I used to talk to Charlie Biederman a lot, and he was one of the last guys, you know, to haul mail between Eagle and Circle. And It was interesting talking to him about those days, you know.
And what did he have to say?
6 days between here and Circle, 6 nights on the river, one way and then coming back. And he'd say, and then they had, they lived at the mouth of the Kandik, you know, that big Biederman camp down there. And they had a, they always had a guy staying there and a fresh team of dogs there. So they changed dogs that far going down and then again coming back. So, and one time, I think Max Beck, who's a nephew of Charlie, owned the last sled that they used. And I think they just gave it to the Smithsonian a few years ago. And they made a deal. Stevens had them all come down to Washington. They had this, been brought this sled. The runners behind that sled is about that far out, see. Charlie says his dad, old Adolf Biederman, used to build those sleds, and that's all a runner he gave him. He said he didn't want those guys riding.
So, and you just put your fingers about
6 inches.
6 inches.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, you can't. There's no way you can get a foot on them, you know. But Charlie said that didn't make any difference. If those dogs could move fast and I could walk, I rode. He said he'd get up on the load or whatever he needed to do. But they had something like a 500-pound limit or something. You know, they didn't have to haul more than that. And, but that's, I mean, you know, 500 pounds in a dog sled is.
Is that right now? But I've seen those postcards of two sleds hooked together and, you know, the captions will say 1,000 pounds or something.
Hauling mail?
Maybe it was freighting, I guess.
Yeah, that would be different. I think he took, now this is what, you know, Charlie told me and I'm just, and I remember that, so, yeah. And they didn't have to haul any more than that. And if they didn't have, you know, if they didn't have that much, and they could, Willie Juniby, the guy from, that owned the fish wheel in, you know, that, in the village, he told me, he knew Percy DeWolf pretty well from Dawson. He said he'd haul down, if he didn't, if he had the room, he'd haul stuff for people from Dawson, you know, he'd even bring fresh meat or something down, you know, beef or whatever. So, but I always thought those were pretty interesting times.
Yes, and how many dogs did they run, say, if they had about 500 pounds?
I'm thinking 10 or 12.
And fairly big fellas.
Yeah, yeah, they were pretty good-sized dogs. And they were, I mean, they were, I'm sure they were husky mixes, but, they, you know, if there was a, there was a St. Bernard that could cut it, he'd be in the team.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't, because a lot of those early dog teams, you know, were actually bred up from a lot of dogs that just were brought up from the outside when the when the gold rush occurred, you know.
Well, so those, if it's, say it was 6 nights, then it would be 7 days, and
It's either 5 nights and 6 days, or Heine Miller, Miller's camp was the first stop out of Eagle. You see, I can't really. I think down at Nation or Montauk was another one. The Kandik was the third. And then there was, I don't know where that fourth one would be, and another one was a cabin just 20 miles or something out of Circle. So, you know, I don't.
Slavin's around there.
Slavin's might have been the fourth night. I don't know. I don't really know. That would be, Slavin's about 120 miles from Eagle, isn't it? So that might have been something like that. I don't really, you know, I don't know.
Well, if it was 7 days, it'd be, it's about 160 miles.
Yeah.
So it'd be about 22 miles a day.
Yeah. He told me he had a, he had a built a fire only at one place. In other words, every other place was lived in. So he said, and of course he was, everyone was always looking for their mail. So the old mail driver got pretty good treatment when he'd hit those roadhouses. And I don't know where that place would be that he'd have to build his own fire.
There's a little ruin down there around Washington Creek, below Washington Creek, I mean just below, called the mail carrier way station, mail trail way station or something like that.
Huh. But that's, you know, they're close to Kandik then. to the Biederman camp itself.
Yeah. So that doesn't make, but it might have been a different carrier.
But, you know, that's right. I mean, you know, they took, I don't know when they took over the runs, the 20s or 30s, 20s probably. So prior to that time, there was mail, so. Yeah.
Okay. Huh. Well, it is, when I was up in Dawson on this trip, I sent a postcard to Eagle and saw him timing it. You know, I've heard a person could bring it down in 4 days, whatever the weather.
That's right.
My guess is it's going to take longer than four. In fact, one of those guys would tell me, oh, yeah, it's going to go Dawson, Whitehorse, Vancouver, Seattle, yeah. Anchorage, Fairbanks, Eagle.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. It'd probably be too well, easy. You know, I think Charlie told me that they had so many days to get the mail there, and then they got docked.
Oh, huh.
And I don't know, I think it was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of leeway there. I don't know exactly know how much. Somebody else might know that, but, you know, I remember Charlie telling me that, so.
I think there's some interviews with Charlie. I got to go look for them.
Well, I'm sure there are. I think the Park Service did some with Charlie.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, let's see. Is there any threads that we just left dangling here? Well, tell me, you go back to Eagle in 79, and this is time when all the noise is happening about, let's back up before that. When you're out here in the 70s, 77, 79, did you have any BLM hassles?
Mm-mm.
Because no. They were kind of trespassing people at that time.
Yeah, I never... No, I didn't get hassled by anybody. I think maybe by that time, I don't know if this land was already in the works to be had by the natives or what the deal was. The only thing I remember in connection with BLM was when I was working on the pipeline, I got these letters from the guy I used to originally trap with, his name is Tony Paul. He's dead now. But he put a claim on this cabin up here of mine. And at the time, he did so to protect me, is what he told me. And I think he did. Because I got a letter from, then I talked to BLM, and they said, yeah, if that allotment or whatever is there is going to protect that cabin because there's not going to be any other land available to anybody, you know, and that's going to protect that cabin for you. So I didn't think much about it, and then until the Land Claims Act came out itself, and then there's a section in there saying, in section 14C, saying that you know you would be deeded property, if whatever you used prior to 1969, whatever this magical date, whatever it was. So then Tony had since died. I got to get this all, you know, remembering. And then his wife and another guy named Isaac Junabe, who worked for Tanana Chiefs in the Realty Division then, a native from Eagle, and I went to get that allotment lifted. Hannah Paul, Tony's widow, said, they don't want it, that's my cabin, and they wanted to get out from under it. You know, give it so the natives could give it to me, you know, because it then becomes Indian land and Hung Witching ground. BIA wouldn't do it. They wouldn't. They'd say, no, that allotment's in place and you're going to get the land and whatever. So knowing that led to the Hung Witching Corporation giving me this ground.
Oh, so that was awfully decent.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They gave Dick that ground. And they Yeah, native local corporations just weren't doing that. I mean, they were, you know, people were taking them to court if they wanted. I mean, there's a lot of people in different parts of Alaska that were, you know, were could show that they used ground that the natives had since been given, see? That's why that section was put in the Land Claims Act, to protect some of the people who'd been out there and kind of homesteaded ground and had prior use to it. But the other, you know, a lot of the other villages, I was told, they were fighting it. I mean, they would just, you know, because it was at the behest of the guy. For instance, if they didn't want to do that and I wanted to fight it, I'd have to start the court proceedings and take them to court, you know, and that's a no-win situation.
Let me see if I have this right. This section in the Milka protected, for example, a white guy who might have been out in the country,
right,
and have the place he used overlain with a native claim.
With the village claim, not the native allotments, the village, okay. Not the private allotments, which are different from the Hungwichen Corporation claims.
Gotcha.
Okay, Hungwichen is the village corporation around Eagle. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Doyon's on the outside of that. So, and you could, you know, I mean, they could honor a fishnet site. They could honor where you had a tent for a camp for trapping or a cabin or whatever. If you could show berry picking, if you'd show use of that, you know. And I just, you know, I finally just went and talked to those guys. Of course,
but now Tony Paul, did he file a native allotment?
Yeah, he filed a native allotment on that ground. And see, they got that. There's a guy living up there now that bought 20 acres of that allotment from Hannah. They offered it to me, and I said, no, I didn't want it, you know.
Who's that, by the way?
That's living up there now? That's Stanley. His name's Stanley, but he just built that about 3 years ago. Stanley Lyman. So he's up there. He's around the bend from my old cabin on the back part of what was 40 acres there. And they gave him, they gave Tony's widow 20 acres up there of the original 40 or whatever. They finally gave her 20 and left the cabins out of it. So the cabins are back on Hungwichen ground. They're on the corporation ground. So.
Okay. And so.
Then Stanley bought that 20 acres from Hannah.
So Tony Paul had a 40 acre.
Claim, native allotment claim.
Within Hungwichen.
Yeah. Ground, yeah.
Larger
block. Yeah, Hungwichen ground runs, you know, all the way up to 70 miles till maybe the Cat Trail or something like that coming out, okay. And then covers a lot of this down towards Sheep Creek.
Okay. And then because Mrs. Paul knew that Tony was really protecting you, and because BLM wasn't going to facilitate that transfer,
right.
The Village Corporation gave you
right.
this chunk?
Yeah. Signed it over.
No kidding.
Yeah, signed it over.
That really is...
That's amazing. But, you know, I mean, I taught school out there, and those were... I had a lot of friends that all... I knew everybody on their board and stuff, and so that was just... And they still are my friends, you know.
How many acres?
20.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. It's really nice, pretty nice piece of ground. It's in this floodplain, you know, but I mean, what the hell isn't down here, so.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's, that's really pretty nice. Now then, we were getting into Cook a little. I'd be real interested, since he just died this summer, and I'm not going to get to talk
meet
with him.
Meet him, yeah.
I met him 10 years ago, so we had a chat, but. Nothing on tape, and I don't know if there is anything on tape. And so Wayne Hall was giving me a little bit of details about recent years, but maybe you know the most about his...
I probably do. Yeah, I probably do, if anyone's still around Eagle.
Maybe you could kind of go through the chronology as best you remember it, him coming into Eagle and then getting out.
Well, he was here before I was. I think he came in about... the early 60s or something like that, 60, 61, 62. And he originally came in to the 40 mile. I do know that. And he was interested in gold, him and a couple other guys. and he eventually matriculated over to Eagle. And then he'd go out. I don't think he was there steady. Year round. I think he'd go out and work in the summers at least. And he worked. He'd work a little construction. He did a little commercial fishing. And then I first met him when I came in 67. It's the first time I met Dick. And we used to visit the school quite often, you know, out there. We both had dogs, so that was a point of mutual interest. And so he lived in a little white cabin there in Eagle across from where the church is now that burnt down not too many years ago. And he lived there. He rented that cabin or just stayed there, whatever it was. And we ran a little in the spring, winters and springs. We ran a little dogs together. We come down after I built this cabin in 68. I remember him spending a couple nights. We'd come down on the weekend or something. He'd come down with me and stuff. But he wasn't, he wasn't living on the river at that time. He wasn't living on the river. And when my family moved down here in 70, 71, then Dick could come down and visit us, and he'd stay overnight with us here. And I had a big old, big tent over a frame that I used for my shop, and I had some bunks and stuff in there. And I had a wood stove, and he'd stay in there. He'd stay there. And I think I think that following summer then, so I'm thinking 71, 71, 72, that's when he started that cabin up there at Pass Creek, okay?
Cabin number one.
Cabin number one, and he got the walls up, and this cabin might have been 12 by 12 or something like that. It wasn't very big, and he got the walls up. And I know it was there because I used to have stuff stashed there. That's where I used to go sheep hunting, and I'd go up that creek. And when I went up there that fall, that cabin was there. And I'm trying to think whether exactly I don't remember the exact sequence of years, but he took that cabin apart because somebody put a claim on that ground from Eagle.
Native claim. So
he just numbered those logs. And the following spring, the following summer, he came in and took it apart. And then took those logs, I'm assuming floated them down off that allotment to where his eventually he was given title to the ground, all of which burned up here, two summers ago.
Okay. Now, where exactly did he rebuild that cabin?
I'd say within a half a mile of Pass Creek.
Okay, downriver?
Downriver.
And on the same side of the river.
It's in behind an island, I think.
Okay.
There's a little island out in front there.
Right, but not on the island.
Uh-uh.
Okay. And then what next for his construction, anyway?
Well, I don't think there was much more construction on Dick's part. I don't think he built much more in the way of cabins,
Didn't this last one he have, wasn't that on the island in front of Pass Creek?
Well, I don't know what was there. He told me the last time I talked to him, he was living a couple tents there.
Uh-huh. On the island?
Well, at that site, wherever that site was.
Okay.
In fact, I helped him several years ago. I brought blue boat, I hauled a whole bunch of lumber for him down to the down to Max Drew's cabin, down to the Yukon in the fall. And I think that was, he hauled that up there to that Pass Creek, I think the following year. And I think he built some flooring and frames, for some tents. At least that's what he told me he was going to do. And I haven't been back there since,
Okay, now, this 12 by 12 that he rebuilt within a half mile, did that burn?
Yeah, that burned about 4 or 5 years ago in November. And, hell, nobody even knew about it till later on. He was going to go outside that winter, and he did go outside. He went outside to visit his, you know, his daughters and his relatives, and he hadn't seen them in a long, long time. And so he had been saving some money, and he told me he was taking a bath, and that cabin around the roof got caught. He said the moss and stuff caught fire, and it was pretty doggone cold. And once he, in fact, I think he said he noticed embers were actually falling down into the, where he was taking a bath, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, the embers were falling, and that's how he, you know, when he knew it, and he just didn't realize it. And he said he got out of there, and by the time he got out of that tub and got a snow machine suit on, which he used to wear in the winter, that's kind of what he wore, a hooded sweatshirt and a snow machine suit, and then some boots. And he got his snow machine suit on and his boots, and he had this cash up there with him that he'd been saving, so, you know, that was foremost in his mind, I guess, and he got that out of there, too. The money that he was saving to go outside. So, and basically, and then that cabin burned, and that was it. And he's, you know, 5 miles about down to the other cabin at the mouth of Yukon, Max Drew's cabin. And he made his way down there.
Any idea how cold?
I think he told me at the time it was pretty cold, 30 below, maybe 30, 40 below. He told me he was awful cold going down to that, you know, that other cabin. And then nobody came by for so long. That was the other thing that was surprising to him. Nobody was traveling the river. Of course, it's still November, so the river wasn't really... too good for traveling yet, and because anyone who traveled, usually they always stopped and seen him, you know, if there was a trail by his place. So, and then, you know, ironically, he did come up, came to Eagle, went outside to see his relatives, came back in like, I'm thinking March, bought a whole bunch of stuff, supplies, shipped to the post office when he came back. Got to Eagle, and he stayed with this little white cabin that was owned by actually Brad Snow now. It was another guy that used to be in the river. And Leaf was staying in it.
Seymour's kid.
Seymour's kid was staying in it. So Dick was jungling up with him for staying with him before he went down river, and he had all his stuff that in his cabin that he had just shipped in to take down and to replace what burned down, you know. So he's staying in that cabin. So they're over Lee's, I don't know where Dick is, but Lee's over the pool, all shooting pool, and someone comes running over there and said, Leaf, your cabin's on fire. They got over there, and that whole damn cabin burned down. And all of Dick's stuff was in it that he was going to take down river with him. So he got hit. He got hit pretty heavy by fire that year.
Well, these recent years have been pretty.
Yeah, pretty tough. Pretty tough. Yeah, in fact,
What kind of stuff do you remember?
No, I think personal stuff. You know, I think probably some clothes, mostly groceries and stuff. I don't. You know, everything was shipped in on the mail plane, so I'm sure it wasn't any kind of building material, unless it might have been tools or something. Yeah, I saw him, I remember talking to him after, I went down to Cheap Creek, as a matter of fact, after this fire subsided, because we were sitting here, you know, and the damn embers and stuff was falling on his deck from that fire across the river, and a chopper would fly every now and then and then look around to see if anything would fly behind us or drop behind us. And then they stopped or landed down the mouth, and they said they had a crew around Dick's cabin at the mouth of Sheep Creek. So I went when it kind of subsided, you know, and I went down the next day or 2 days later and went down to see him, talk to him. First I went down there, and that crew was still there, and that fire was still pretty much in the area. And they had pumps and everything, you know, ready to run, and they had watered down a lot of his stuff. And then I went down again after everybody pulled out. You know, I went down to see him, and we talked and stuff, and he was really down.
Hang on one second.
So, yeah, he was pretty down, and he said, he just first time he ever talked about going somewhere, you know,
moving out.
He said that all this stuff, he originally lost in the fire at Pass Creek, you know, in that cabin, and then the whole surrounding, and then the area come and burned again, and then that cabin in Eagle. And then, now
that fire, let's see, so it was 4 or 5 years ago he got that cabin burned down.
Yeah.
And then same year he lost the stuff in the Eagle.
Yeah, following spring, November and March.
Okay. Then, so, but after that, between that and the 99 fire, so he rebuilt something up there around Pass Creek, probably tent frames.
As far as I know, they were tent frames. Yeah. You know, now Wayne Hall might know that because he'd visit them. You know, I just haven't been up there since.
And so, did the forest fire get the tent frames, or were they able to save that?
No, I think he built those after the forest fire. See, I don't think he really rebuilt back there until after that forest fire went through.
Okay, so he was mainly down that kind of his...
Yeah, he was around the mouth, you know.
But he was down in the dumps because of...
Yeah, so much. But, yeah, and then I was going to go on to save him that point. And then at some later date, you know, I saw him in Eagle, and hell, he's back making his lists and planning, you know. So he's back feeling pretty positive. Plus the fact that, you know, hell, he wouldn't have any place to go. Comes right down to it. I mean, his lifestyle had been so much here that he could have gone someplace, but it'd been tougher than hell for him to do that. Yeah. So
he didn't exactly have like many people, kind of a foot in both worlds.
No, not really. He was capable of doing that, and I think, you know, he could have done it, but it would have been tough for him, you know. No, you know, it really, as it turned out, he was 70 years old, you know, when he drowned, and to my knowledge, he never fought any kind of sickness. I mean, never had anything wrong with him. And if he did, if he had any aches or pains that might preclude something being, you know, physically wrong, he never said anything. So, you know, and he was right down there where, you know, he's always been and probably would have wanted to stay, you know. So there was maybe some justice to that whole thing. I don't know. But I know, boy, in the last couple of years, he was living pretty tough, pretty basic. I mean, he really didn't have much. Like, the people that went up there, you know, looking for him, like they said, there's no food in that cabin. He didn't have anything to eat. So he was living, and this was summertime, you know. It wasn't like springtime. No, it was summer. Hell yeah, it was July. So he was living pretty tough. He never did have much of an appetite. He didn't eat all that much, you know, and he didn't sleep all that much. He never slept all that much. He was a real
low maintenance guy.
Yeah, low maintenance guy. He'd never liked to cut all that much wood either. I mean, he had wood that he burned, you know, that night or whatever. I've talked to a guy that said that, you know, if someone put wood in at night when they're getting ready to go to bed or something, he'd stay up until that
heat of that wood was used up. If not, you know, he'd take the damn embers back out. And, oh. Well, yeah. But he always liked kids, and I always thought, you know, that that might have something to do with, you know, I'm sure he left whatever that divorce was back east before he came to Alaska. He missed those kids, you know, and I think kids through the years, like my own kids, you know, who are now grown. But he always, you know, he always liked to talk to kids, and he'd like to. I remember he showed my two little kids, who are now, like they say, in their 40s, how to live trap rabbits, you know, with a blazo box and stuff. And man, they got a big bang out of that. They catch these rabbits, you know. So, and he liked to do that. That's one reason he used to like to visit us, I'm sure, you know, because all my kids were there, and at that time there weren't any other kids on the river, you know. I mean, none of the other people who were on the river had kids; they were all young couples. There were Charlie and Cher Edwards at Shade Creek, Dave Evans, and whoever his lady was. I can't think of her name.
Sage,
yeah, and. Brad Snow moved down there, but then he moved back to Eagle before freeze up. So, but that first year that those guys showed up, that was the first river people, which is about our second or third year here, you know.
And Ovi was about that time above Eagle.
I first saw him in 75, 74 or 75, when he and his brother and Little John Gaudio and Lynette. I first remember hearing about them moving up that cabin about 74, maybe, 74, 75. But now, Steve Alvey never, which he told me, and you know, I don't think they considered themselves river people, per se. He wasn't into heavy trapping. He wasn't into... he told me one time, you know, as far as he was concerned, nature didn't guarantee him a living. And those were his words. Because we went up to Dawson one time, took our dog teams up, and we spent a couple nights on the river and stuff. And so he was more he was more of a environmentalist even then, you know, although he hunted, you know, and he trapped a little. But some of these guys down here in this river, I mean, they took a lot of game. They shot a lot of stuff. You know, I mean, they made no bones about it. And I don't think Steve was really into that, you know, to that extent.
Like shooting moose for dog feed?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Steve and his brother were awful good, and they're tough guys, and you know, they could travel and build stuff, and you know, they were good.
Did he trap up above here somewhere too for a while?
They trapped down around Trout Creek, up above Trout and Washington Creek, up in there. Eventually, Charlie Edwards first trapped up in there, and it was in a burn area, and the burn was a big the Nation Fire of 1969, and so by this was a few years later, and that the marten were in that doggone area big time, you know, hunting those mice, and these guys, Charlie Edwards, started taking scads of marten out of there, and then when he left the country, I think he sold that line, or you know, the right to trap it and the traps or whatever, to the Alvey brothers, is my understanding, who then trapped her and did really well. And then at some point they got in a big old row with Mike Sager over the same ground or some of the same ground. And yeah, I haven't thought of many of these things for years. But I don't know how that, I don't know which ground was which, but I do know that those guys got that ground from Charlie Edwards.
Yeah, I think I have Ovi on tape talking about that, something like that. Sager was more in that area, but Ovi kind of bought it off of Charlie Edwards, and if I have it right, Sager felt like, well, I'm the next guy in line because I live around
the trap
next door or something, which was interesting because also, if I remember right, Ovi had a dispute over a fishing site up near where he was, where the guy who had it and fished it, then when he would leave, Ovi would move in afterwards and use it. Well, then the guy stopped fishing it but passed it on to somebody else.
Yeah.
And Ovi thought that was not okay because he was the guy living there. So it's kind of
two
different logic. I have to ask him that one.
Yeah, there was something that I remember that, but I forget who the other party was, but I do remember that problem.
So the sort of the law of the North here is not always very clear.
No, it's not. I mean, it was more so in the olden days. I think guys were pretty territorial, and if they developed a site, no matter what it was, they were kind of everybody else honored it, where there was a trap, if they cut it and stuff, developed it themselves, or a fishing site, you kind of honored that. Have you heard of Pollock Joe?
Yeah.
Hey, Jack? See, he was on this river. He actually wintered down in Nation, I think about the same time we moved down here, and he was a good trapper, and he traveled with a snow machine, and he broke down. He had all kinds of trouble, but he trapped those drainages. He trapped Trout Creek, and he trapped Nation, and all the way down to Coal Creek, before any of those guys were down there, And then he continued to do that more or less when the early guys moved down there. They weren't really on his line yet. But Charlie Edwards was up here. Evans was there on Nation, and Pollock Joe, and he kind of showed them how to catch some lynx, as a matter of fact. And they don't think that was a big deal. Then more and more of these river people moved in. Sager was one that came into Trout Creek. This is after, like I say, I was out and working on the trap line, or working on the pipeline. And when I came back, then moved back down here, well, then Joe was coming over here, and he wanted to trap again. And he brought this guy with him, Mr. Dwayne Bowers. And they were mining on the 40 mile, and Joe was going to come over here. Now, this is what they were telling me, because they'd stop at this cabin up here. Now, this was 77, 78 in there somewhere, maybe 79. I forget what year that was that he actually got killed. But they were coming over here, and they'd stop. They were freighting stuff down to the cabin, down to Nation.
Over the 70-mile trail.
Well, yeah. No, they'd come down the Yukon by that time. And they were going to trap down there. And I remember talking to that Dwayne Bowers. We got to know him as he'd stop, and then they'd have coffee and eat and stuff. And Joe got a lot of gold. He worked hard and got a lot of gold out of there in 40 mile. So he had met Dwayne Bowers on the pipeline or whatever, working. And so Dwayne wanted to go mining with him. And Dwayne, now what Dwayne Bowers told me, he said that... He's coming over here. He doesn't really want to trap, but Pollock Joe wants him to come over and trap with him because he got all these guys living over here on what was his trap line, what he always thought was his trap line. And he was right. I mean, he was here a long time before any of these guys were, including me, as far as being, living on the river. I was actually an eagle before him, I guess. So, but anyway, so Dwayne said, so... because I want to get in on this gold operation on the 40 mile, I'll be part of this trap. And Dwayne Bowers was a big guy. And Pollock was just a little guy, and, you know, he wasn't really, very adversarial, you know, but apparently he thought old Dwayne was going to be with him and help him get his trap line back or whatever, but it never panned out because they went on and got shot, you know.
Do you know that story?
Oh, yeah, well.
I like to have that story.
Well, yeah, that story was, you know, Dwayne Bowers lived several hours in Chicken after he was shot, and so he told the story. And it still got, these guys still got off. They were going back over there, and they stopped here, and I'll never forget that, because we were living up that cabin, and Dwayne Bowers came, and they came back to the Nation, and he sat in there, and he was eating something with us, and he said, I'm going back over the 40 mile, and I'm going to pick something up, and Joe's going to stay over here.
What time of year was it?
Just before Christmas, 21st, 22nd of December. And I'm going over and get that. And he said something to the effect, no, he didn't say that until Joe came. And while he was eating, we saw this light coming up the river. Well, it was Joe coming up. and he came into the house, and he said, I decided to go over with you. I'll run over there with you. You know, we'll both go over and stuff. And so they talked about, at the time, then they both had something to eat. And he said something about that Russell family that's over there. And they had trouble that summer over an area. There's a big, long bar near the mouth of Napoleon Creek over there. I don't know if you're familiar with that area over there.
Just a little, drove out the road.
Yeah. It's down from about 5 or 6 miles down below the South Fork Bridge, down the South Fork River. And Joe had been getting his gold, you know, off that bar for quite a while, you know, using the suction dredge and the diving equipment stuff. And so they were going back over there, and that Russell family was living there in a cabin, you know. In fact, Joe got that family over. There was a man and a wife and a kid, 14 years old, David, and then there was a little girl by the name of Angel or something, who was like 6 or 7. And then they had this guy with them by the name of Charlie Bruns. He came in originally in the country with Randy Brown, in my understanding. I never knew that Bruns at all, but I was told later that he and Randy came in together. So anyway, in the meantime, he got together with somehow with his Russell family. And they were over there, and they were living there in the winter, and you know, right in the vicinity of this, where this gold mine is, or this free ground is, or wherever they mine it, in the bars right there at the mouth of the river, mouth of the Napoleon. So anyway, they went over there and took off, you know, and said they would be back in a couple of days or whatever, you know. Jesus, next thing I know, somebody comes down, and I think it was 2 days later, come down and said, Pollock Joe and Dwayne Bowers were killed over there by the shot by the Russell family. So, you know, I didn't know anything at that point, but I talked to Dale Reichert, a guy who now lives in Tok, had lived in Eagle and at that time was living in Chicken. And Dwayne Bowers, they went over there, and they went over there snow machines, and then Dwayne had a scout, you know, an old GMC scout, old like a Bronco or something. And you could drive down on the ice to this Napoleon Creek, 5 or 6 miles down, you know, from that bridge. So they went down there, and got out of that scout, and whatever they were going to do, they were down on the river itself, you know. And apparently these guys just unloaded on him. That David Russell shot Joe in the side with a high-powered rifle, and that killed him instantly.
Was David the 14-year-old?
Yeah, he's a 14-year-old. Charlie Bruns had a 9mm, which he proceeded to shoot
handgun,
which he proceeded to chase Bowers, shoot him, and chase him back towards his scout. He hit him about five or six times. He hit him in the thighs, you know, hit him in the lungs. And Duane got back to his scout, and he had two things happen. He got hold of a little shotgun, 16-gauge shotgun, had birdshot in it, which he had in the scout. And Bruns was changing clips or something, and I mean, it jammed on him. So he was having trouble, so Bauer shot him in the legs. And then he climbed in that scout and drove away. Well, he managed to drive all the way back up to that bridge, you know, wounded as he was. And he got on that road, and another couple who lived in that area came by in a pickup and got him, and they took him into Chicken. And then they took him, I think, either in the post office or there was a building there. They were building bridges over there, and there was a camp there at the time, whatever construction outfit had that, you know, they had this building, and that they took him one of the two places. Dale Reichert got there, and so he talked to Bowers quite a while. And they called, you know, called people to come in, and they choppered in. That was a big mix-up, too. But anyway, they got in there, and several hours later, he lived. But, you know, Reichert said that in that time, he told them, you know, he related this story as to what happened. And they got, these guys, medics got in there. They came in with a chopper from Fort Greeley, and you know, Dale said you could hear his lungs, you know, were filling up and stuff, so he was shot pretty bad, but man, he must have been tough. And then he finally came in, and they were giving him a shot of adrenaline or something, and he just threw his body back and died just like that. Yeah. And Joe, you know, and then these two, this Bruns and this David Russell, tried to run or something, and he got in the car, and I think they were driving all the way into Chicken at that time. They kept the road open because of that bridge crew or something. And but anyway, the word got out, and the troopers came in and caught him on the road, actually. And so that's how that happened. And
now, they were, according to the story anyway, they were completely unarmed when they were shot.
Yeah, they had been having some trouble that previous summer. And in fact, the troopers had come in that previous summer and, you know, talked to them both, because they were both, you know, both trying to mine in the same area and whatever. And because there was gold in these damn, you know, they were sucking up some gold out of there. Joe always did. He got a lot of gold out of there. And, of course, he had made the mistake of taking that Russell family over there a summer or two before that. So, you know, it was his fault in a way that happened, but... But the trooper said, you know, leave the guns out of here, no guns or whatever. And so that's one reason they weren't armed. And he had this damn little shotgun in his scout, and those other guys, man, just blew him away.
So how did they get off?
Shit, I don't know. They painted that Russell kid. Well, they painted, first of all, they bring him to trial looking like a choir boy when, you know, out in the woods he looked like he, you know, he's an animal or something. And then they painted Joe as some kind of crazy bastard, you know, that, you know, he'd, and I didn't go to the trial, but I know people who sat through the whole damn thing.
Like who?
Lou Flynn. She lives in Eagle there. Dave McCall's outside now. He ran a Chicken saloon for a while. He went to, at the time, I think he still did, he still own that store in Eagle? I don't recall that. But Lou, I know Lou Flynn did.
Was this a... Do you know what year that was?
77, 78 or 79, I think.
And was it a big story covered, Anchorage Daily News or anything like that?
I don't recall. I was still down here and... I know Fairbanks did. I know the Fairbanks, Fairbanks Daily. No, Fairbanks Miner, News Miner.
Did cover it, huh?
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 They covered it. In fact, I think Lou's got it. I think she's got kept the clippings out of there. I'll have to talk to her. Yeah, she lives in Eagle. Okay.
Has it been written up any other which way, do you know?
Yeah, not to my knowledge.
You seem like you were going to say when Joe joined up with the other guy there at your cabin that they said something, they indicated something.
Well, they said something about the Russells. Just that, you know, I mean, I didn't even hardly remember it except that, you know, something effective, you know, hope we don't get having trouble or something like that. Something to the effect that, and see, at that point, I didn't even know they'd had any previous trouble with them at all, you know, that summer, that they were, you know, at odds with these people. But there's a lot of drugs in that family. I found that out later. That family was, they went into a lot of drugs.
Is it still in the country, or?
Well, the old man died. That David showed up at Central Alaska, and he was involved in mines. That was several years after. My kid, Patrick, ran into him, I don't know, at a bar, or a club or something in Fairbanks, much later when, you know, they were older and stuff, and he had remembered him from Eagle or something, you know, whatever, but I heard he had some more trouble and tried to burn up a half-brother in the camper. I mean, it's real strange. But there were some people, and they were on the 40 mile for a while, and there were some people that had found themselves on one of the cabins over there. I think right at the bridge before that new place was built. There was a cabin there, and a lot of these mining types were there, and you know, drug types too. Actually, it was a lot of both of it over there. And someone said that family were there, and they were really scary. You know, they were into I don't know what. Satan stuff, Satan worshiping, or something that was really off the wall. That kind of bothered even some of those hardcore guys over there, you know. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I was kind of interested in looking into that story a little bit. Let's see. Did we finish off with Cook? So recent years, he had whatever camp he had up at Pass Creek, which was probably 10 frames. And then the Max Drew cabin at the mouth.
Yeah, other than that, he owned like, I think he had 10 or 12 lots in Eagle up on the ridge. You know, there was an old, broken down trailer. But I don't think he could even live in that anymore. It seems to me when he came to Eagle and stayed, I think Steve Nelson had a cabin he let him use alongside, in behind the well house there. There's a little old cabin that, I know he stayed there when that first cabin burned down in November, when he came to town, before he flew out then. I know he stayed there for several days.
That place at the mouth of Drew Cabin is pretty rough.
Oh, terrible. Terrible.
He's actually still living in there.
Yeah. Well, it was completely flooded out about 91 or 92. I mean, the river backed up, and that water was, and I think there was that, I flew with a guy, and there was that much of that cabin sticking out of that river, and Dick was up in a cache. He was up in a cache with us. He owned two dogs at the time. They're up in the cache with him, and they stayed up there for 2 days.
In 92, August, that would have been the year after I saw him. At that time, 91, he had a nice garden.
Oh, he could grow a hell of a garden when he put his mind to it. Yeah, he did. I think it was that year. Yeah. Yeah, he could grow a fabulous garden.
In fact, speaking of him liking kids, I was floated down with my wife and little boy. I was about six. And I remember him picking my boy a big old green cucumber, you know. It's just a beautiful
thing.
And gave it to the little boy. And he was fishing. He had a net across the river. He had a gal visiting, I guess, too.
Yeah, that gal.
Named Pat.
Now that, several years ago, her son, did you hear that story?
Yeah.
You know, that's why. That's how he got. He didn't know her before that kid got killed. Yeah, I think, and then she wanted him, but you know, to
go ahead and say that because our future listeners won't know it.
Well, it just I can't think of the kid's name now. Maybe it was Tony or something. Anyway, he came and he spent some time with Dick, you know, and I guess he had, you know, a lot of people read Coming in the Country, so you know they kind of get enthralled by you know, Dick's lifestyle or whatever. So this kid came, and I think he was just like 18, 19, a young kid, spent a bunch of time with Dick, and then later went somewhere in Southeast, and I think he was backpacking, and he was mountain climbing or whatever, and I think he got killed in an avalanche. I think that's what it was. Or a rock slide. I don't know what time of the year it was, but anyway, he was buried. And so after that, Dick and his mother, and her name was Pat, became friends, and Pat would come visit. And I remember he'd come over to school when I, you know, and use my office phone whenever he'd come to town. He did quite often because he was, you know, he was keeping in contact with her. In fact, I think, I'm trying to think whether he visited her when he went outside.
Oh, the time the cabin burned.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that. But it seems to me that might have been one of his reasons for going outside too. But anyway, he'd come over to school and late at night, you know, later in the evening after I was, and I just leave him in the office, and he'd use his card or whatever, and he'd call her for, you know, Dawn. I think she's from Dallas, outside of Dallas or something. And she was a nice lady.
Yeah. Yeah. But I took a peek in that cabin a few weeks ago on the river, and it looked like a bear lived in there.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really tough.
Yeah, that's what I say. He was living awfully close, you know, the last few years. You know, he'd have, like, in that cabin down there, he punched out a window and built some plastic. He had chickens in there, you know.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
I was wondering what that
was. Yeah, he was raising some chickens. In fact, there was chickens that he was bringing chickens up to Wayne Hall, and which they found dead and drowned. You know, they did find that crate of chickens. So.
Yeah, I thought, what's that, a little greenhouse? That didn't look like a greenhouse. I couldn't figure out what that was.
Yeah, no, just for the chickens.
Yeah. Boy, you didn't end up leaving much behind there, you know? And it already looked like it was becoming a ruin, you know, a site where somebody lived 100 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
He's kind of helping it on it.
Well, I'm sure that cabin had to have been built in the 20s or 30s originally, you know. You know, I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
Because I know this, when this Max, historically, when Max Drews was around, and they've got there's a big section of the, up above Harold Nevers' mine on the road out there, they call it Max Drews Glacier. And it glaciers up and runs across that road every winter, and it becomes pretty treacherous. So somehow, I mean, Max Drews must have had something to do with that area up there, too.
Well, it's too bad to lose him. Well, now, I don't want to take up all your day, but I do want to get you to comment on just your reflections on how life on the river was affected by the coming of the Park Service and Anilka, and then becoming Yukon Charley National Preserve. And one thing anybody looking notices is that before they came, there were quite a number of people living on the river and living that kind of subsistence life of trapping and fishing and running dogs and that kind of thing. And now there just isn't.
Well, that's true. Now, whether whether a lot of those, you know, those people would have stayed living that lifestyle indefinitely anyway, without the park, is, you know, is open to question.
People always came and went, but now they can't come.
Yeah.
They can only.
Well, people wait. Didn't. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah, that option's no longer there. course, they hadn't really been... I don't know at what point, what was the last stage of people before we moved down here, you know, before, you know, because no one, unless there were some people close to Circle, when I was, you know, when I was at the village, no one was living on the river anywhere, you know. And what I was told is that the end of the war, and the end of the building of the Taylor, the end of the war and the end of the steamboats, the sternwheelers, was kind of a turning point as far as people being on the river, living out on the river. Well, of course, the natives were still traveling in those days quite a bit. They were still hunting and stuff. But, I mean, they weren't, you know, they were in the villages, you know, and they'd travel to hunt. Maybe go out on trap lines for a couple months in the winter or something like that, but they really weren't, you know, they're permanently, they were still in the village. But,
late 40s, when was the Taylor built?
53, it opened up. Okay. So, and see, those are the kind of years that coincide with late 50s with Eagle having 9, 10, 11, 12 people in it,
yeah,
too, you know.
Okay.
So, I mean, that, and you can, all that stuff goes to kind of, you know, say that that was the case. There weren't many people around, period. I mean, there was no living to be had on the river, you know.
And some of these old guys dying around it. I know,
yeah,
Chris,
yeah.
Nelson, like 49, I think.
Yeah. There was... four or five old-timers still in Eagle when I first got to the village. You know, a fellow by the name of Joe Burzett and Almond Hagen and a couple other guys. And they were kind of the last of, like, the old miners. But they weren't doing anything. They were just kind of existing, you know. They were down in there near the end of their lives.
But a little while after you came, in the 70s, but before 1980 and Anilka, there were all these people we were mentioning, like Evans and Snow and Edwards and Danny,
yeah,
Brown. And,
yeah. I think from, like I say, 71, 72 is when I saw the first, you know, first guys move in. And then between 75 and 77, that's when Seymour and Sager, some of these other guys showed up, Randy Brown, and then they were on the river till they left. I'm trying to think of the chronology of the park. And
so about 1980, I guess there.
Well, like 79, yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, there were people coming in to tell the villagers what was going on.
Yeah. Well, I remember, I knew by 77 there were guys in here. And, I remember when we came back here, I can remember by that time they were talking about the park and they were talking about, I mean, there were several different things on the drawing board for how much that park was going to entail, you know, and one of them was right smack up against Eagle, you know, and I think what really as far as the amount, you know, I think there's a timeline there of when Reagan was elected. And then when he took office, and this bill was signed in December, that interim period, because I think they were, I think they probably, like, this park was less than it was going to be at one time. So I don't know if that, you know, that had anything to do with it or not. But by 77, it was a foregone conclusion that it was going to be here.
And and you were still up a mile up river here, and But you felt okay about your security because the
yeah, as far as being able, yeah. Now I didn't know what was going to was going to happen in relationship to hunting, you know, or trapping. And of course, I knew I wasn't going to, you know, I knew I was going to be going back. You know, I didn't know. Actually, I thought I'd be going back teaching someplace else. I really didn't know I was going to be teaching the Eagle. But I knew I was going to go back into teaching and at some point. And then this thing in the Eagle opened up. And
so even if you had to leave, it wasn't going to be that big a deal?
No, no. Mm-mm. No. I mean, I would have liked to have been able to retain a place, just like this, like it worked out, you know. But no, it wasn't. No, I don't. And the thing is, you know, have you run across the name of a guy at Washington Creek, Errol?
Yeah, Errol Wilson.
Did you know Errol?
No.
Well, Errol is a guy that a lot of these other guys, you know, I never really thought much of Snow, you know, personally. But that's beside the point. But I can remember him, a statement in McPhee's book, I think it was him, saying something about when oil was discovered or something, when the pipeline started to be built, when oil was discovered, that, you know, that was I knew it was going to be the end of me on the river, something, the words of that effect. Well, you know, Wilson stayed down there for a lot of years after that. You know, I mean, he did his thing. You know, he probably was curtailed a little bit, but I mean, you know, but the other guys just, I think it was their time to go. I didn't think the Browns were way up to Candic. They had an area to, you know, to live in. That's where they were living anyway. But it did. You damn sure didn't have the freedom, you know, of being able to do anything you wanted to do, you know, really. That's what it amounted to. You know, you could stay out in this river and, you know, you could shoot anything you wanted anytime you wanted to. I mean, really, if you look at the bottom line. And then just the fact that there was going to be now an authority a lot closer, you know, that was going to be a difference. And, you know, maybe that has a lot to do with, you know, everybody leaving and going somewhere else. But,
well, as I talked to a lot of these people, they all have kind of different, often different, very predictable reasons for going. Like some of them had kids and, you know, they reached a certain age where they wanted them to get more
socialized. And that's true. I mean, that's a damn good reason for going. Yeah.
And it's, like I say, kind of predictable and inevitable. But what was different was nobody could come in and replace them. And then the other thing was, even if you wanted to stay, say like Richard Smith way down there, you could get, if you signed over all your buildings to the Park Service, you could get this 5-year renewal permit. The discretion of the superintendent, who was changing about every 3 years.
Yeah.
And so now it's a nice guy, but who knew about tomorrow? Yeah. And then your children who were in the cabin at the time of the act could also inherit the right to have this renewable permit. But after that, no. So in other words, another way to say it is, in the course of one generation, there would be no subsistence people living in the park. And so the act says we value subsistence living as an important value and should be protected.
Yeah.
But the regs provide for its demise.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, if you could get into that a little, I kind of think that is a value. That's a neat thing. And I hate to see it disappear altogether.
The subsistence?
Yeah. To have real people doing the real thing out here before it becomes, you know, a few Park Service GS7s, drama majors from outside living in those cabins.
But, I mean, I think that's a natural... That's the natural, you know, thing to occur. Though, I don't think. I mean, philosophically, why would they want you? You know, why would they want to keep allowing subsistence? I mean, it really goes against the grain of everything that they really want to see happen. You know, I mean, they can put that in policy and in the regs and everything, which they can change at any, you know, whenever they want to. But I don't think there's any compatibility with what they really think long term for what a park ought to be and what it should be doing, and then people, you know, living within the confines of the park, subsisting or whatever you want to call it, you know. So
it's sort of a
inevitability that I mean you can look at McKinley, you know, and then